programming is sponsored by Clean and Sober Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. Bottle of wine, fruit of the vine. When you gonna let me get sober? Let me go home and start over. Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio. Brought to you in part by Recovery Centers of America, the nationally recognized leader in drug and alcohol treatment, using proven evidence-based treatment, including 24/7 medically supervised detox, inpatient and outpatient options. You'll receive exceptional care from an expert team of master-level clinicians, physicians, nurses, and staff using 12-step methodology and medications. Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region, a proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825, and Acadia Healthcare, with locations on the East Coast. Acadia maintains a standard for excellence in the treatment of behavioral health and addiction concerns. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Hendler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about addiction to drugs and alcohol. We'd first like to thank some of the great stations across America that are broadcasting Clean and Sober Radio, and they are WWDB out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, WWNN out of Boca Raton, Florida, WHFS out of Tampa, Florida, and KDWN out of Las Vegas, Nevada. And starting next month, we're going to be on WGAC out of Augusta, Georgia.
It's great news, Gary. We're getting the message out all over the place now.
We certainly are. On today's show, we're going to be talking with an old buddy of mine, David Lichtman, and we're going to hear a real story of addiction and recovery. So it should be really, really interesting. And what I'm so happy about is that David and I are still here and we're alive, that we can reminisce and we can talk about the old days and then be thankful for the new days.
Isn't that amazing when you have a buddy that you go all the way back with and you both found sobriety?
Yeah. Let's find out what's doing this week in recovery news.
Yeah. So this week, if people are familiar with the player Henry Ruggs that played for the Las Vegas Raiders, Alabama coach Nick Saban came out on record saying that leadership might have prevented the tragedy that tragically killed Tina Tintor in November, and he was driving with a 0.161 blood alcohol level. He went out at 3 in the morning, and he had been drinking with his girlfriend and friends. And so the coach said that why didn't anybody take his keys? That this could have been prevented. He might have been mad, but why did no one take his keys?
Well, you know what that story shows me, tells me? Nobody's immune to an addiction.
Yes.
The most famous, the most athletic, the richest. You can get yourself jammed up, and then you can pay for it for the rest of your life.
Oh, yeah, and Henry Ruggs is facing up to 46 years in prison. Imagine going from being an NFL star and playing for the Las Vegas Raiders and now facing all this prison time.
Well, that's a horrible story,
I know,
isn't it?
I know, it sure is. And it really makes me think, because all of us could have been there, right?
But, you know, we hear these stories all the time about famous people who get jammed up. You know, because I think there might be a headset. You know, when you're rich and you're famous, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, you think you're okay, and there's so many bad influences out there.
Yeah, absolutely. You have real quick. You have
one other quick one was the drug companies settled for $26 billion this week. 46 states and 90% of local governments signed on to this settlement. It's supposed to go to the opioid epidemic, but we learned last week that a lot of that's not true. Yeah, going to insurance companies.
Last week we heard only 7% of these settlements are going to where they should go.
Yes.
The rest are going for administrative. They're going for legal.
Yep.
And all sorts of stuff.
Inside scoop here, right? We got that inside scoop last week, and it's very frustrating to hear because the newspapers play it up like it's all going to the opioid epidemic.
Yeah, that's sad.
It really is, because all that money, imagine what that could do, $26 billion.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Yeah. All right. When we come back, we're going to bring our guest on, David Lichtman, and we're going to find out what his early life was like and how did that lead to his addiction and criminal activity. And we'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're struggling with alcohol or drugs, Recovery Centers of America can help. RCA's local inpatient and outpatient programs are founded on science and delivered with heart from an expert, caring team who will inspire and guide you every step of the way. Call 1-888-RECOVERY now to speak with a treatment advisor. At RCA, you'll be in a community that builds connections and fosters support from peers and RCA's team of medical professionals and recovery support specialists. At RCA's state-of-the-art campus in Devon, PA, and Mays Landing, New Jersey, they tailor your treatment to you and also offer specialized programs for patients with history of trauma, for patients who have achieved recovery but are experiencing a relapse, for young adults, adults 50 years and older, a confidential program for first responders and military, and a faith-based program. RCA answers the phone and accepts patients 24/7, and because it's local and in-network with insurance providers, treatment is affordable and accessible. Don't wait. Call 1-888-RECOVERY. Recovery today.
Hey, this is Jackie Marling, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio. This is still Jackie Marling, and you should listen to Clean and Sober Radio. Everybody should listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're just joining us now, we're going to bring on our guest, David Lichtman, who has led a very colorful life, let's say. As a lot of us have. David, welcome to the show, my brother.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm so happy you're here. You know, I was thinking earlier, I love when an old friend comes on who was in it with me in the midst of addiction and then in recovery, because when I bring friends on, I don't have to read their book. I don't have to really know anything because I already know about the person.
So yes.
It's a relaxing show for me, Mark.
And I love it because every new friend he brings on, I hear another insane story about Gary Hendler that I can bust his chops about later.
That's exactly right.
That's the important thing.
So, David, okay, so you grew up outside of Philadelphia. We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
What was the family life like? What was it like?
Very tumultuous.
Uh-huh.
My parents really didn't get along from way back. A lot of yelling and screaming. Mm-hmm. Things I really probably ought not to have seen, I did. Parents arguing and fighting and all that kind of thing. So early life, my parents were good to me, but their relationship wasn't very good.
It's trauma. Traumatic.
Absolutely.
And right, take Mark? It all. Yeah, and kids take that all in. I mean, they'll have their own way of trying to cope and escape with toys and all that stuff. But really, they're taking it in like a sponge.
Yeah, that's sad to hear. So, okay, so parents, did you live with one of your parents or did you go back and forth? What was going on?
Well, my parents split when I was 16.
Okay.
My mother did offer me the opportunity to come with her, and we'd get an apartment.
Yeah,
but I chose to live with my dad. And I, if this program does anything, it maintains integrity and honesty. So, truth be told, I said I wanted to live with my dad because I knew I could do whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
He didn't come home at night always, and I had people partying and coming over and. Truth be told.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. You took advantage of the situation, like we all do.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, at that age, especially with that going on, you had to be wanting to escape, right? How did it go with your mom? How did she react to that when you decided to live with your dad?
I really didn't have much contact with her. probably should have, but
yeah. And David, I know this. You dropped out of school early.
Finished the ninth grade.
Ninth grade, amazing. So, the authorities or your parents, or did anybody say, "Hey, wait a minute, we can't let this kid drop out of school in ninth grade"? How old were you in ninth grade? 30? How old were you in ninth grade?
I was 15.
Yeah. So what happened? You just said, "I'm not going back to school."
Well, I went to school in 10th grade.
Yeah.
and I kept cutting classes. So what they said to me was, every class that you cut, we're going to deduct that from your roster. Okay? Mm-hmm. I ended up at the end of the year having two classes.
That's all that you got credit for?
I failed. I flunked those as well.
So did anybody at home, in either house that you were living in, did anybody say, hey, David, you're not dropping out, or what can we do, or what's going on here?
Well, going into my 11th grade year, they said to me that we're going to put you in a special ed class.
Yeah.
And I said, if you do that, I'm going to drop out of school. Okay. So they let me go to school in 11th grade, and I cut classes. I was actually repeating 10th. And one thing led to another, and they gave me a little box, a voice box. I don't know if you'd ever seen them in high school, but they were carried from class to class by one of my fellow students, and I had one at home, and they could broadcast the class to my residence.
Wow.
Yeah. But I used to just – it was a joke to me because I would hit the play button and at the same time having like Jethro Tull playing on the disc there. And people would come over and we'd be smoking dope and hitting the button to speak and – it was a mess.
Yeah, what I remember, I don't think we met until you were about in the late teens.
Right.
So, I heard stories about you. So look, you had a traumatic upbringing. You took advantage. The easy parent, I would have done the same thing, your dad, because you get away with anything, I'm assuming. And then you were on your way to all the drugs and the criminal activities.
Absolutely.
What were your friends? Did you have a group of friends that were not addicted? No, nobody. Everybody was doing what we were doing.
At least smoking.
Yeah, at least smoking.
Right.
Yeah. You went to juvenile detention center, didn't you?
I did.
What age?
16.
Okay. How come you were sent there?
I was arrested a number of times for burglarizing a doctor's office, for
Quaalude prescription.
Yeah. No, just the Quaaludes.
The Quaaludes, yeah.
And I got arrested eventually for burglarizing a house that I could get the stereo and TVs and all that kind of thing, and trade them to people for weed or for those kinds of things.
Were you scared, like, at that age doing those things? Like, was it scary for you, or were you just kind of like, set, I got to get my drugs?
Well, when I was breaking into the houses, definitely my heart was racing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I knew it was wrong.
That's good you knew, because you could have been in a state where you didn't know it was wrong.
Yeah. I would have been a sociopath at that
unbelievable.
Point.
Hey, listen, we have a lot of people watching already and listening. Claire Campbell, Laura Story, Jeff Phillips, Kathy Wolf Collin, Jim Carlson, Debbie Reynolds, Valerie Lansky, Stephen Sussman from South Florida.
All right.
David's Steve, brother.
We were just talking about David earlier.
Yes, we certainly were.
And I knew him too.
Yes, you did. Patty Weeks is watching. John Reagan is watching. Rick Trevain is watching. David is a good example of the benefits of the program. As it is said, keep going to meetings and the miracles will be revealed. David is a miracle. He certainly is a miracle.
Sure is. And I got one. I want to say hello to Alan Trobman is watching.
Oh, is he in Florida?
He's in Florida, but he comes.
He's with the retreat, isn't he? He's with your
organization.
Yes,
he's with the organization. He goes back and forth from Florida and Pennsylvania.
I don't think I ever met him, did I?
Great guy.
Yeah.
I probably have.
Can I give a shout out to some people?
David, do it.
Go for it.
To my Uncle Paul, my Aunt Susie, my Uncle Ronnie, my Aunt Elaine, my brother Craig. And I was going to give a shout out to Rick T. and Beverly.
Yeah.
As Rick says at the end of meetings, I'm here for a checkup for my neck up.
I like that.
Yeah.
All right.
Anybody watching or listening? Any of your relatives?
Yeah, at least my Uncle Paul and Aunt Susie.
I'm really fond of them. Very cool people. So, you know, we're going to get into a lot of stuff here. But, you know, I just want to jump back. We do recover, okay? It's not a dead end unless you're dead. And there's plenty of resources out there. And as we say every week, there's no delivery service and there's no drive-thrus to get into recovery. But places like Recovery Centers of America and Jefferson Hospital and Jefferson University and Acadia, these are all viable places to get clean and sober. And then, listen, just go to meetings, man. And they're free.
Yeah, and, you know, I think all of us at some point felt like we were completely losing hope. You know, completely like, hey, how am I going to get out of this? I don't know if I'm ever going to get out of this. And it's just so amazing just knowing, you know, if you are out there struggling, that there is hope. You can get better. You know, we're sitting here all sober, which is a freaking miracle, especially Gary, you know. I mean,
especially me. Listen, if you need help, call us now at 1-888-329-3306. We will get you help. Or call the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. There is help out there, guys. Don't waste all the years that David and I wasted, you know, and you wasted.
Get the help.
You know, it's a waste.
Speaking of Thomas Jefferson University,
yeah,
in sobriety, I went to school there, and I got a baccalaureate degree in diagnostic imaging.
That's right. You did. You did get educated after all that.
I had that, two associates, a paralegal studies certificate. Recovery has been fantastic.
Yeah. But you know what? When we were out there, we didn't want to hear it.
No, of course not.
You didn't want to hear this.
Yeah. And I don't know about you guys, but I remember first getting into recovery and really thinking, like, my life is over. Like, I'm never going to have fun again, you know, and it's amazing how that changes, isn't it?
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And it's true. We never had fun afterwards.
Yeah.
You know. All right. So, David. Okay. So, the first place you were incarcerated, did you escape?
I escaped a couple times.
Tell us about that.
Well, like I said, I had been arrested for a burglary, which sent me to juvenile detention center. Mm-hmm. And in the detention center, I met up. Actually, they sent me to reform school at George Junior Republic near the Ohio border. I was there for 4 days, and I jumped out the window with somebody else, and I saw the sun going down in the west, and I had to go down in the east. So we started heading east, and he was originally from the Pittsburgh area. So we bumped into this kid who he must have known, but he never said anything, and he offers to stay at his house, his parents' house, for the night. I mean, I guess God really does work in mysterious ways.
You didn't have, like, a uniform on with stripes?
No, regular,
regular clothes.
Regular clothes,
yeah.
And so we stayed the night. The next morning we got up, he had given me a bag of food, brown paper bag, and so my fellow escapee headed towards Pittsburgh, and I went to Penn State campus.
Okay.
And I hooked up with my buddy, Larry Fern, who was a freshman there. And I stayed for about a week. Then I hitchhiked back east, and I went to my parents' house. And the next day, the cops came, and they arrested me and took me to juvenile detention center.
Where?
At Lima, PA.
Glen Mills?
No, just the detention center.
What was Glen Mills?
Glen Mills was not juvenile detention, but it was a reform school.
Okay, okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so they took me to the juvenile detention center. The next day, I'd hatched a plan with Ronnie G.
Oh, no.
You can say
And we were going to escape together the next day out in the field. We were playing ball the next day. And it was time to go, and I'm, like, signaling towards Ronnie, and he balks. I go over the fence. anyway, they caught me, like, 2 weeks later, and they took me back to the juvenile detention center. But needless to say, they wouldn't let me out in the baseball field again.
So really?
Yes.
How did they, like, is it like in the movies, like you went over the fence and like they had like, did they have like their guns out and stuff?
Or juvenile. They're not even allowed to use barbed wire. At least they weren't at the time.
Yeah.
So,
but the they put out, if you want to say an APB, and said this kid escaped and all the police counties were looking for you, or detectives.
So the next day they let me into the gym and there was a beam on the side of the wall. And I shimmied up it, kicked out the window, jumped to a roof, to a lower roof, and ran. I started hanging out down there in Wildwood, New Jersey, and panhandling and sleeping with ever anybody would let me. I made a lot of girlfriends back then, and they let me kind of spend the night. And I used to get a free meal at the hospice or whatever they called it.
Were you seeking drugs at all? I mean—
Ripping and running, Gary.
Yeah.
Beating people out of, you know, their drugs. They would let me sell them. I'd do them, whatever. Anyway, end of August, I went back home, and the police came. And out the back door I went of the house, and the cop, it was like a lull because nobody came right away. And I just turned and put my hands behind my back. Anyway, a cop came and arrested me. It was like the next day or so. They took me, it was a Saturday, I think, to the court by the director of the detention center. I said to I was a con then. I said to the judge, "Oh, Your Honor, I never got arrested. I was working." It was all a con. I worked one day. Fortunately, he didn't ask me the name of the place that I worked at. They let me go.
If you're just joining us now, we're talking to David Lichtman. Listen, the stories that we have are funny now in a way. Mm-hmm. They're funny and they're sad. But, you know, he's been, you know, David's totally honest, nothing to hide. And hopefully it'll help somebody hear the horrors of an addiction and try to cut that run short. Or you're going to go through, you know, and David is lucky, like Mark, you and I are, that he's here. He should be dead.
Yeah, and the loss of control, right?
Yeah.
You know, the loss of control and the desperation of having to do anything, you know, to stay high or live the lifestyle. And, you know, some of it, of course, we all had some good times, right? But, you know, when we play that tape to the end, it always just turned out bad.
It turned out bad. And I know for me, I pretty much was self-medicating.
Yeah.
And I kind of had to do drugs, or I felt paranoid. I was later diagnosed with bipolar schizoaffective disorder.
Oh, wow.
And that's pretty much, I think, the schizoaffective disorder was what I was trying to medicate.
Yeah, and if people aren't familiar with that, again, it's a mixture where it's this mood fluctuations and things, but there's also a psychosis element to it, you know, where somebody
Very
can
good.
Have grandiose delusions and all kinds of stuff. Were you getting breaks from reality, like psychosis?
Well,
you weren't using or
that? No, not really. Mm-hmm. That happened to me actually in sobriety.
Wow.
Back in like 93.
So your symptoms came up to the point where were they delusions where you thought, you know, maybe God was talking to you or.
I thought the TV was talking to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not happy to say it, but that's the truth.
Wow. That's scary stuff. You know that?
It
all
is.
Starts out as fun and games, and then it doesn't. Listen, when we come back, we're going to talk to David, and I'd like to know what his thoughts are about how his childhood and the trauma precipitated your criminal activity and your addiction. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Center is Eastern Pennsylvania's premier provider of transformative care for individuals whose lives have been impacted by addiction. Our 40-acre campus offers a tranquil, recovery-focused environment. We specialize in evidence-based care that addresses the effects of trauma and offer a unique program specifically for adolescent males. Huntington Creek Recovery Center can help you achieve lasting sobriety. Call us today at 844-948-8255. 888-382-2320.
Hi, this is Simon Kirk, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Guys, just remember, there's help out there. You know, there's so many resources out there to get help, and you know, either inpatient, outpatient, meetings. Try to make a decision. You've had enough.
Yeah, enough. And you know, you can go to meetings even if you haven't made a decision yet. If you have some desire at all to stay sober.
Yeah. Hey, John Hollis is watching, and he says, "Odette, John." You know what? Mark and I don't know what that means. Maybe
Probably everybody else does, Gary.
I guess I do. Ted Klotz, nowhere to hide. Addiction will get you. Ain't that the truth, David?
Huh? Sure is.
So what do you think your child what part did your childhood play in your nutty behavior?
Well, I can say from the drop of a hat, I started abusing drugs. Actually, marijuana.
How old were you?
I was 13.
Okay.
And from the very beginning, I was hooked. We got a nickel bag of marijuana, and I split it with a schoolboy friend of mine, David Nasilla. I don't think he's in the program. Okay. So right away, I started dipping into the bag, trying to, like, take advantage of the situation because I kept the bag in our house in the garage. So right from the very beginning.
What did it do for you when you first started smoking weed? How did it make you feel, and what did it take away that you didn't like?
Well, I don't know about the takeaway. But I think what I had been living up to that point, I just don't know if I could be myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was drinking too and doing things like finishing a whole bottle of wine at that age and getting sick. And it was no deterrent because it kind of took me away from reality.
Yeah,
It's sad.
You know, it's sad, but, you know, I just remember, I guess for me, when I started taking the Quaaludes, it made me feel so good, and it made me get out of the space that I was in. You know, whether I felt like I looked weird, I sounded weird, whatever it was, it took me out. And for a while, that was a great thing.
Same for me. Like I said, it made me feel great, especially that first rush of the Quaalude when it hit you.
Oh yeah, we can still remember that. I mean, Mark's too young; he doesn't know. But let me tell you,
Mark, I'm glad I was too young.
Let me tell you something: when those ludes hit, your fingers, your lips, and then look, David's laughing.
I'm laughing because absolutely
it's true, and we can laugh now. But, you know, it was fun for a while, and then it became this is not good, you know.
I couldn't socialize unless I had a Quaalude.
Right, right.
Isn't it amazing? We were actually just talking about that last night, about how, you know, in the beginning it's like, hey, I'll do them here and there just to, like, help with, like, partying. And then eventually it's like, I can't do anything without doing them, you know, or feel weird doing it. I mean, it's very strange how the brain disease takes over.
Can I tell you something?
Yes.
I'm embarrassed right now.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Eric Jacklin says ODAT means one day at a time.
Are you kidding Gary?
Listen, Eric. Mark and I knew that. We were just testing.
We did not. And I
how
can't.
How stupid are we?
This is just the stuff you and I do.
I know.
I mean, everybody else probably knows what that means.
And we've been in sobriety so long.
Yes.
And we're like, you know, it's like, say, what's the big book?
We've been in the program for so long. They didn't have those things.
Okay, that's David. That's a good one. It's new stuff, so we wouldn't know about it.
We should have known this. We should have known it. I mean,
oh my
come
God.
On.
John Hollis posts this, and we're going, what does it mean?
I know. Doesn't surprise me, but, huh? You know.
Yes. Yeah. C. Ruger's watching. Hi, everybody. That's really funny. So, do you know where you were the first time you got high?
First time I got drunk, I was age 11 at a holiday function, and I think I had two or three glasses of wine. I overdid it from the day one, from the drop of the hat.
Yeah.
I overdid it. First time smoking marijuana was that that time, like I mentioned, I went in with for a nickel bag. Well, that was the first time.
11 years old. When you think about that, it's, geez. Can you put into words why an 11-year-old boy would want to get drunk, get high? The pain, you must have had so much pain, David, that you need an escape. It, no matter what it was, you had to escape.
And I did have pain.
Yeah.
Were your parents, were they alcoholic or one of your parents alcoholic?
My father had a problem with alcohol, and thank goodness he gave it up back in the 80s. Now, he did pass last March, and he'd been clean and sober ever since then.
Yeah, great. Good.
So you were witnessing a lot of drinking at home.
Not really. He used to go to a restaurant over there called the Angus. The
Black Angus, City Line Shopping Center.
Yeah. Yeah. And he used to spend a lot of time there. So.
But, you know, I'm just so curious. I was probably 14 or 15 when I started. I don't know how old you were. But, you know, 11 years old, you're supposed to be at 11 years old, riding your bike around, doing stupid things, not needing escapism.
Yeah, I started early too with alcohol, but I think it was because of my older brothers. I was watching them do it, and you know, so I would start having buddies over at like 12. You know, and
really,
yep, and getting really drunk too. Pretty scary stuff.
And did you think? I thought everybody got high. It's not
totally.
True. There were people who were responsible our age and didn't do this nonsense. I mean, robbing houses. Most people didn't do that, you know.
Yeah. Your beautiful daughter, Sophia, says at that age, it's pure curiosity and environment.
Is that what Sophie says?
Yep.
Yeah, Sophie's cool.
Yeah.
Sophie's been through her own stuff for sure. But she's good now, you know. She's very aware of what goes on. I think addiction does make us very aware and street smart.
If we make it through it to the other side, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it is crazy too because then your hobbies start going away. All the things that you're into—is that what you found?
Absolutely, and it took me a while to put the two and two together. But when I was a kid, I used to have the greatest toys. I had a mini bike. I had a little road racing set with the cars and everything. And
yeah.
I used to go to Al Berman's for clothes a couple times a year.
See, he was privileged, you know. They had
my parents were good to me. They were
good to him, and they had money. You know,
yeah,
that's good. Mini bikes, go karts, right?
Did you find like when you started using, almost like a void open up? Like I just need to fill this void.
Well, I had a network of friendships as a result. But again, it was to cure some social ill or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Insecurity.
You know, because I remember you back then, what I can remember. And it's like, oh, there's David Lichtman. And it was like, I mean, I'm so messed up and I'm judging him, okay? But I remember you were a little, for somebody like me, I thought, he's a little shady. You know that? Meanwhile,
you
I'm robbing places myself.
Wait, whoa.
Yeah.
We got to put it. So you thought that David was shady.
I thought Dave was shady. And just like he mentioned Ronnie G, you know, we know.
Oh, he was
we know
shady.
What
he was
about.
Shady, yeah.
It got to a point with him where it was fun and games, and then I got afraid of him. because he started to go over the line. Yeah. And, you know, I used to hear stories about David Lichtman.
Let me tell a quick story about Ronnie G.
Yeah.
Ronnie G showed me a bottle of Quaaludes that he had. He had 80 Quaaludes in a vial, and he showed me where he put them. He put them in his closet on a shelf. So Ronnie went to Florida for a vacation, I think, with Gary.
Yeah, he did.
And maybe
David Sussman.
David Sussman. Yeah, yeah. And what did I do? I took a big rock and threw it through a sliding glass window, and I went in there and grabbed the Quaaludes, and I didn't go out the way I came. I went out the front door of an apartment building in Winfield Heights.
The Imperial Towers.
I'm picturing you as the guy that could just get away. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he was quick. He could climb. He could, you know.
He could maneuver real fast. I think I remember that. Well, it was David. It was Sussman, Goldberg, and me. We were in Florida when you did that.
When Ronnie came back, he came over to my residence.
Yeah.
And he never asked me point blank, did I do it? I don't know what he was trying to accomplish, but I'm sure he knew it was me.
Listen, there's no honor among thieves, let me tell you that.
Yeah.
I mean, any of us would have ripped anybody off. That's another part of this addiction. Besides the intake of the drugs, the behavior, man.
Then it just starts getting so out of control.
Yeah.
You know, just the unmanageability that we talk about.
And if David or I didn't get sober way back, we'd probably be incarcerated in a state facility.
Right.
Instead, you got a pardon.
So I got a presidential pardon. There you go.
It's
the rewards of recovery. Yes.
I was still almost fell off my chair, but
yeah, I know you did. I know you did. But look. Recovery isn't all fun and games, but it is certainly when you start out, it's a great baseline to have a great life, have a responsible good life.
And like I said, it's been fun. It's been exciting. I've had my problems, but I don't know. I just, you know, I certainly don't have to worry about where I'm going to get the next drug or become homeless, because in the end, I did become homeless. And it was at the end when I was homeless that I hit my bottom and I was done. I was done with drugs and alcohol. And I went to my last detox out there at Chester Crozier Hospital. And that was my last detox.
How many places were you in? Do you remember?
Detox
and in and outpatient.
Probably 10 or so.
Yeah. You see, there's an example. The insurance companies have to keep paying because it took him 10 times and he got it. Help people pay for recovery.
Yeah, we see it all the time. You know, you just see how it's rarely a one and done in terms of in the beginning, somebody just, you know, they get treatment and boom, they're cured, or right? They're sober. So yeah, absolutely, Gary. Absolutely. And I was curious about being homeless. Like, were you in Philadelphia homeless, or like, were you in California, or, and what was that like?
Talking about ripping and running and being fast, I ended up staying at the house of, her name was Lisa. It was her mother's house. And I was staying there, and her mom and I went and got a bottle of cough syrup. She forged the prescription for Tussinex. Okay? And she drank first. Then I started drinking. And right then and there, drugs no longer did what I had designed them to do. And that was at that moment that I said, I'm done. No more drugs or alcohol. And off to the Crozier Chester I went.
That was it? Wow. At that moment, that was it?
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow. Why do you think that was it? I mean, you know, some people say it's a spiritual way. What was it? We don't know, right?
I don't know. I don't know where it came from.
Yeah.
So you finally had that, moment of clarity.
Epiphany.
Epiphany. And
had feel enough. Like
the
right?
pain was just so great being homeless at that point?
Yeah.
How old were you when you got clean?
23.
It's young.
Yeah.
You were 23, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I wrote it. I went on for a couple more years.
23
years.
I count my sobriety date, the day that I entered my last rehab, called Abraxas. Mm-hmm. And I went to Abraxas, and the whole treatment process lasted maybe 2 years.
Oh, wow.
You mean you were in and then outpatient therapy? Is that what it was?
Inpatient.
Yeah.
Halfway house, outpatient. The whole thing lasted about 2 years. And it was at that facility that I had a spiritual awakening. And it was kind of just tabled with rigorous honesty. Mm-hmm. And I was at a meeting the other night, and I said that I thought the two went hand in hand, a spiritual awakening and sobriety. I don't know what came first. But I got both of them.
It's like clean and sober. Clean is you put the stuff down. Sober is when you start making the right choices.
Right choices. Honesty. I if that is any of my strength, then honesty would be about it. And it's gotten better and better over the years.
When you decided to get into treatment, did you have support from your family?
Well, I had support of a girlfriend. Her name is Mary Bates. I don't know if she'll be listening. But she continued to respond to my letters. And she used to go and buy stuff for me and send it to me. And I used to get these little care packages. And I used to read GQ there. And I would see what I wanted, and I'd contact her, and she'd send it. And when I got home, I had like a leave over the holidays. I would stay with her. Mm-hmm. And after I got out of the process, although I kept an apartment, I spent a great deal of time with her. Altogether, we were on and off for about 7 years. She was a little bit older than me. And
she was very helpful and instrumental in your recovery.
Absolutely.
She was a stabilizing figure.
She loved me.
Yeah.
When you said spiritual awakening, was it like a Bill W. bright light moment, or was it sort of like you said you discovered that rigorous honesty? Was it just that clarity?
Well,
tell us about that.
It became clear that it was a behavioral kind of treatment, and what they would do is they would have punishment for bad behavior. And it was after enough of these bad behavior incidents and the penalties that went along with them, I don't know where it came from, but I knew I had to be honest. Now, I did something called EST.
Oh, yeah.
And in doing so...
Can you explain that to our listeners, our audience?
It was called Earhart Seminars Training. It was founded by this guy, Werner Earhart, and it was basically dealing with all types of reality. And in my last imprisonment, what they did was I wrote him a letter, and I asked him for a little book that they gave you at the end of the treatment center. And I opened it up to a page that indicated that if you would say the truth, then eventually it would be called law in your universe. Now, I started doing that, and I kept doing it and kept doing it through rehab, detox. Anyway, later on in life, I had three dreams, and that was to hang out with Ann Archer, meet Richard Gere, and to see Clint. This is in sobriety now. Now, I met my girlfriend out there, Deborah Kelman, who had a prior relationship with, I'm sorry to say it, Clint, and she introduced me to
Clint Ann Eastwood.
Okay. She introduced me to Ann Archer. And I've been to her house a number of times. And one night we hit the red carpet, black tie affair. Clinton was there, Richard Gere, and I went with Ann and her husband, Terry. And afterwards we went to a restaurant. We're getting everywhere by limousine. We walk into the restaurant and Richard Gere is standing at the next table. And Ann made introductions. So I lived out my dreams. I can only attribute it to telling the truth time and time and time again. And these things happened. Now, I have not had, well, that's not entirely true. I have had truthful things happen since then.
But, all right, let's do this. Hold that thought, because we're gonna have to run to a break. But if you've just joined us now, we're listening to a story from David Lichtman. You know, a lot of people have the same kind of stories. It's the insanity of addiction. And when we come back, we're gonna talk about how David, what his life is like in recovery after all those years of criminal activity and addiction. And it's quite
amazing.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to David Lichtman. And David, you wanted to talk about the final point of when you stopped using.
Okay. At the point that I stopped abusing drugs, I went with a bouncer. His name was Rich, and he was a bouncer for one of my Quaidu doctors. Very quickly, that is a doctor that I doctor shopped around and had a number of doctors at the same time prescribing similar drugs or the same drugs. Now, the last time, and eventually I started using heroin, injecting it. So the last time that I did heroin, I ended up going with Rich to Northeast Philly in the projects. Now, I'm a Jew boy. I got no business at 5'7" to be hanging out in the projects. And in fact, Rich said, don't get out of the car. Mm-hmm. What did I do? Got out of the car. And that is to the extent that I was willing to go for drugs.
Yeah, we do anything. And steal from our own families. You know? Okay, so you get sober 41 years ago. How did you make the transition from the old days to the new days? I mean, you know, once you got into recovery, was it as simple as, my life is totally different now. I'm going to be totally honest. I'm not going to hurt anybody. Sometimes it doesn't work out like that. There's a process even in recovery. Did you have the process?
Well, I took a little bit from each of these playbooks. I did mention Est.
Yeah.
And the 12 steps of sobriety, of which I have right here, a book of 12 steps and 12 traditions.
Sure.
Meeting makers make it. I like what Rick said. Again, check up from my neck up. All the slogans, they absolutely...
Keep it simple, stupid.
All of it.
Don't be too hungry, angry,
lonely, and tired.
Yeah, all that, yeah.
All that.
Yeah.
It fit me right away. And but as time went on, I think the benefit has been the length of sobriety. Because as I mentioned to you, Gary, if you only stay clean or sober, eventually you get to be normal in a sense. Again, I don't want to say it hasn't been done without the program, but just living life. I mean, it has taught me so much. It's with the program, I've gotten a little bit more humble. Ego and anger and all those kinds of things, the seven deadly sins, have diminished over the years. It's great to have to be able to go to the 12 steps and 12 traditions and
of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
And in there, it specifically deals with the seven deadly sins. And every single one of them can be applied to David Lichtman. Envy, I used to be murderously envy in the beginning. I was just envy, and I had really nothing to be envy about. I had the support of family and friends. People had gotten me jobs. Uh-huh. I've had a good education. And it's been a process of becoming more humble. I said that before.
You wanted to read the Serenity Prayer, which actually we've never read on this show. Why don't you read it? And, you know, people that are in the program now will know what it is. And people that are not in the program, it's something you should really listen to because it makes a lot of sense. Why don't you read it, David? Serenity okay. Prayer.
All right. Now, this comes at the end of step 12. Just very briefly, I'll tell you what the 12th step is. Very briefly. Okay. Step 12, which is at the end of the 12 steps. There's 12 of them. Step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and drug addicts, if you will, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. At the end of the 12th step, there's a serenity prayer. With each passing day of our lives, may every one of us sense more deeply the inner meaning of AA's simple prayer, and that is as follows. God grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and wisdom to know the difference. And that is it.
That says it all, doesn't it?
It right? Sure does.
It really does.
It sure does. And yeah, so what a miraculous journey you've had. You know, what a miraculous journey. 41 years.
Do you have any words for somebody that's still suffering, alcoholics and drug addicts out there? Do you have any words of wisdom or any suggestions to these people?
Well, I can. Maybe the words of wisdom is bring the body around and the mind will follow. If you're really on the precipice or you haven't really found the program or finished your last drug or drink, just act as if and then you'll begin to think as if and then feel as if. Go through the motions, put aside the drugs and alcohol, go to a detox, and go to a rehab. If they'll do one thing for you, and that will be to ruin your drug and alcohol dependence. It will ruin it for you, which is a good thing.
It'll ruin the high for sure, won't it?
You'll know it's wrong, and but you'll do it anyway.
Yeah, no, good words.
And all you need, right, is a desire, some desire to stay clean.
Right.
You know, you don't even need a desire. Just go there. Even if you don't have the desire, it might, you know, at some point it might click.
There you go, Gary.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what happened to me. I when I went to rehab, I only went in there to beat a charge. That's the only reason I went in.
And you stayed sober? And you stayed sober for a year before you had your first girlfriend? Is that accurate?
How long
is a year?
For you, it was 2 days.
Oh, yeah. For me, not for you, Mark, right?
No.
No, no. Well, we are both very happily married.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, well, I did get engaged a couple times in sobriety, but...
Okay. But you are, you know, I'm... Look what you've done.
And it ain't over.
It ain't over.
Like to hit the big 50.
You're waiting to hit 50?
No, the 5...
Oh, 50 years of sobriety.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Is there anybody else that you want to meet out there? I mean, you met Clint Eastwood, Richard Gere.
I didn't meet Clint.
Oh.
I saw him.
Okay.
I asked Deborah to see him. And I did. This was a black tie affair, red carpet. Clint was the honoree. I sat amongst all the stars out in the seats. Clint was the only star that came out on stage and didn't sit with us. Costner was there, Julia Roberts, Richard Gere, Mimi Rogers. Gorgeous, stunning woman. You listening, Mimi?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Maybe Clint's listening, too.
Call me.
Just real quick, because we got a lot. There were so many people watching.
They loved your story.
I hope so.
Betsy Green, my wife Marjorie Hendler, Ted Klotz, Joel Cooper in Florida, Nancy Minnick. What a story this woman says. Yeah, Nancy, he does. I don't know if you realize it, David. You really shouldn't be here, and you're here, you know? So, listen, thanks for being on the show. And remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. Please call 1-800-662-HELP. For Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
I'm Mark Sigmund.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about this broadcast, please join our mission and go to cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com. Have a great, safe, and sober weekend, everybody. Right?
You got it.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Till the sun that loves you brown. When the system.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.